Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 13, 2008. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. Got two guests lined up for tonight. First, we're honored to be joined in the studio in a few minutes by Adolfo Gili, one of the most distinguished historians of Latin America. And we'll be talking broadly about what's going on in that very important part of the world. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be talking with NYU professor Elaine Tobin, who is a scholar of celebrity. We'll be talking about the political economy of fame in the present and what it all means and who's making money on it. Before we get to all that, just some of the usual words about the economic news. Evidence continues to mount that the U.S. economy is now in recession. Last Friday, we learned that 63,000 jobs disappeared in February, the second consecutive monthly loss. January's decline was revised down and now appears as a loss of 22,000 jobs. I should emphasize that these are preliminary estimates that will be revised several times. Most of the time, the monthly numbers are pretty close to reality, but at turning points, they can be a little off. In recessions, the labor statisticians often underestimate job losses. In recoveries, they often underestimate gains. The two consecutive minus signs in the early estimates are very unusual outside recessions or in their immediate aftermath. So given that the losses could be worse than reported, it's looking more and more like the job market is really contracting. Losses were widespread. The goods-producing sector led the way down as construction lost 39,000 jobs and manufacturing is off a huge 52,000. But unlike earlier months, the gains in services offset losses in goods. This time, private services were off 12,000, with the retail, finance, and professional services subsectors all down. About the only sectors showing any kinds of gains were healthcare and bars and restaurants. Two areas have been very strong for the last few years. Together, these two have contributed 75% of the job gains over the last year. That just doesn't strike me as the picture of a dynamic economy unless we overeat, overdrink, and then check ourselves into the hospital as our new economic model. The public sector added 38,000 jobs, though, last month, but that's likely to change in the coming months as the recession takes a toll on government revenues, forcing state and local authorities into hiring freezes or layoffs. The unemployment rate fell last month, but mainly because of an enormous withdrawal of 450,000 people from the labor force. For most of modern history, the labor force has grown faster than the population. In the early 20th century, more people left the farm to join the formal workforce. In the later 20th century, women left the household for paid employment. Those trends meant that a growing share of the population was working for pay. That trend looks to have plateaued. Obviously, the farm couldn't get much more depopulated than it is, but it also looks like women's entry into the wondrous world of working for pay, and I put it that way because women have long done plenty of unpaid work at home and continue to do so, that trend seems to have flattened out. But, as they say on TV, that's not all. While it's been predicted that the labor force growth would slow as baby boomers aged and took early retirement, with a smaller cohort of young people taking their place, things are not turning out that way just yet. The share of older people, that is 45 and over, working has been rising, while the share of younger people, 25 and under, has been shrinking over the last couple of years. And Latinos have often also been withdrawing from the labor force in large numbers, much more than white and black workers. Part of the reason for this is probably the housing bust, since Latinos are heavily overrepresented in the building trades. But it may also be that the effect of the growing hostility towards immigrants is having an effect. Employers may be afraid to hire Latinos, and immigrants may themselves be lying low. Interestingly, the Bank of Mexico is reporting that remittances, that is cash sent home by Mexicans living abroad, were down 5% for the year ending in January. A few years ago, those were growing at a 20 to 25% rate. Again, it's probably the housing bust, but it's also likely that a lot of immigrants are self-deporting, as they say. I find this very distressing news. And adding to the recessionary feel, the Census Bureau reported this morning that retail sales fell 0.6% between January and February. The annual rate is now lagging behind inflation, meaning the real volume of retail sales is falling. Leading the way down are housing-related sectors like building materials and furniture. But high gas prices are sucking up a lot of cash, so it looks like people are cutting back on discretionary purchases like clothing and gadgets and just buying necessities like food. The question really is no longer when the recession will hit, but how bad and how long it will be. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Adolfo Gili. And that a bit of the Toccata number 9 in E minor, BWV 911 by J.S. Bach, performed by Martha Argerich. And we're now joined in the studio by Adolfo Gili, who is a very distinguished historian of Latin America. His most recent book in English is The Mexican Revolution, which was published a few years ago by the New Press in a series edited by Howard Zinn. Welcome to Behind the News, Adolfo Gili. I want to start by asking you how serious is this rebellion against neoliberalism that seems to be spreading across Latin America? We're seeing Venezuela, Bolivia, to a lesser degree Argentina. Is this really how historically important do you think this is? Is something really happening with this?
Thank you for inviting me. First, yeah. Second question. I don't think that it is that we have a rebellion against neoliberalism. People do not know what it is. We have a rebellion, a kind of rebellion that for the time being is democratic and electoral, against the consequences of neoliberalism over the common people. That's the question. So they vote for the candidates or they push forward the leaders that are against those consequences. I mean layoffs, repression against migrants, all that. But I think that is really important, but we shouldn't say, in my opinion, that neoliberalism is in danger, because I am among those who think that neoliberalism is a new stage of the state of things in this world, of how capital and work relate themselves, of the relationship between humankind and nature, which is worsening and worsening, and nobody can stop it. I think that we are in a new age, and that's really neoliberalism. So people rebel against the consequences and the policy and want to change that. And that's right. But I won't expect that they could change the general neoliberal trend in a long time. That's my idea.
What do you think is responsible then for that underlying trend that you were just talking about, that transformation of economic life and the relation to nature?
I think that trend started around 75-80s. In the 75 or 80 in the last century, and that was a response of the powers that be and of financial capital against a lowering rate of income for them.
The falling rate of profit.
The rate of profit, thank you. That's the right name. And they reacted using the technology that was already at their hands before, after the Second World War. So we had a long spread of new technologies which put back labor, which weakened the positions of labor, unions, base, and all that, and that then changed the war even for the financial war. So it's an incredible war for all people, this one in which we are, in which production is fragmented all over the world and then reassembled. And when the manpower of India is used in this country freely and the other way around. So this global world, technicas de comunicación informational and communication techniques.
ICT, you say.
ICT. Yes, yes. Well, we say TCI. through the ICT, among other things, is a fantastic change in the world in which capital and capitalism works in the world. And we are really at the beginning. So it has very bad consequences for climate, for people, for a lot of things, for wars. We have wars because of that. But this is the new world in which we are, and people is trying to fight back the consequences of that. So they vote candidates, they try to change governments. I think that they may be right in doing so, but I think that we would be wrong if we think that we can change in a short time this general trend. I prefer to think that we have to fight for better conditions of living, for better relationship with nature, against wars inside this system. It's not difficult, it's not easy, because the system means war, means not taking into consideration nature, means all that. But I think that that's the way in which we have to affront this situation and not be optimistic about going back to old development days and to old welfare state. That was good, but it's over.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up because for the first 20 or 30 years after the end of World War II, there was a Keynesian welfare state in the northern countries, import substitution regimes, nationalist protectionist regimes in much of Latin America. That got burst apart in the late 70s, early 80s. How do you think those regimes came about, though, the early part of the, you know, in the 60s, 50s and 60s? What was responsible for the stability, apparent stability of those arrangements that that's now gone? But what kept them together for those decades?
I think there are many reasons. You know, as always, there are many reasons that explain state of things, state of affairs. But first, after the Second World War, people everywhere, also in this country, felt that they had war, that they had done a lot of personal sacrifice. People who went to war, families, all that, and they wanted their rewards for that. And then a lot of people, workers, colored people, black people, everyone, Indians, asked, well, we won the war. We lost tens of millions of people, and what's for us? And that's important that we have to take, that is important to take into consideration. Because if not, we go only to the figures of the economy, which are important. But the figures of what the people are ready to ask. Do we take it into consideration, really? I think that was one of the questions. Second, that through the war, the economy grew. The American economy reshaped itself. Third, that during the last years of Roosevelt, there was already a change in the economy, and what we call the welfare state started in 37, 38. You remember the Detroit strikes and all that, and the big unions. So those big unions who contributed to the war, after the war, asked for their rewards. And all the common people, the poor people, asked, well, what's for us? And the economy was not in bad shape. There was a reconstruction in Europe. There was a lot of field for investment. And there was new technologies already that could be used that didn't exist before the war, that were developed during the wars, because the war developed technology always since the Greeks. So it would be a long talk about that, but I think that we can find and that researchers and professors have already found the reasons for that. But that had an end. The turns and up of the economy are the normal way in which the economy works. That's, we have to acknowledge it. It works like that. Then you are going to ask me, and when will come the next turn up? And I will answer you, I don't know.
Okay, well, you save me that question. I'm speaking with Adolfo Gili, who is the leading historian of Latin America, joining us here in the studio. And, you sound rather pessimistic about the possibilities for resisting these trends within the broad capitalist world economy. A lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere, and quite a few in the South too, I guess, are deriving considerable inspiration from what's going on in Bolivia, Venezuela. They see some considerable resistance that actually uses that word socialism to describe its political project. Am I getting unjustifiably optimistic about this? Are these false hopes that these are harbingers of a better world to come?
Well, you have interviewed, I think, a lot of people, and you have to know that any time that you say that to somebody that he or she is pessimistic, he or she will answer, no, I am a realist. So I won't say that I am realist. I am rather optimistic. Because I can, first we have to see that this kind of system is here to stay. That we are not going to overthrow it in the way of the, well, all welfare state or the Russian Revolution or whatever. It's here. But I think that the people who are struggling against its consequences and that want a new kind of world are doing well. For instance, in Bolivia, for instance, in, I don't know, in, even in Brazil, in those countries. And also, I don't know what happens in China, but in China, the workforce grew to the double, the industrial workforce, in 20 years or something. So those are new workers, as were new workers in this country at the beginning of the 20th century. And they will find their ways to have what they think they need to have, and they are merecen, how do you say? Not they are allowed. They merit to have. They have to have. They are inside the system. They are going to change the world. You know that you have strikes in India and strikes in China are not the same as the old strikes, are other things. They are asking for other things. They are asking for things that we couldn't. For instance, I never asked for a computer when I was young because a computer didn't exist. I didn't ask for a car because the car was very far away from what I would ask in Latin America. And now they do. And there are new relationships there. And the old costume is changing. And if you go, I work at the UNAM, at the university. The UNAM is the national university in Mexico. And the young people that have the, have the age that I used to have in those times, in the 50s, well, they have a new relationship. They are much more free than we were in their relationships. They have an open world. It's seldom do not travel abroad, and so that is making a new kind of relation between people in this world. I think that we cannot imagine yet the ways in which they will invent ideas to fight back the ugly situation of neoliberalism. The big problem, I think one of the big problems, anyhow, is the relationship with nature. That's terrible. That's terrible. And
yeah, all those people who want cars are in the process of destroying nature.
You know what happens in the Pacific? The soup of plastic that is over an extension in the Pacific Ocean, twice the extension of this country. It's a plastic soup there, wandering through the surface of the Pacific Ocean. How can we answer that? How can we answer another problem? Great states that are arming themselves more and more because now we have not only one powerful country. China is arming itself. I am against countries who arm themselves, but also this country do, so they have to fight back. So Europe too. Russia is again there. It's again the old Russia, which for a time was called Soviet Union, is again there, the old power of Russia. India too. And when in the world have been plenty of arms, well, they have to be used. That's the problem. How can we avoid that? I have no answers. So I am not pessimistic nor optimistic. I like life, and I like very much what young people is doing everywhere. It's fantastic. You couldn't imagine when we were young. But this is the world that is. So I understand. I have not given any answer to your question.
That's fine. You know, we're very free form here. I'm speaking with Adolfo Gili, who is a historian professor at UNAM, the National University in Mexico. Well, let's talk a bit about Mexico. It seems like, politically speaking, the country is very divided. The last election was almost 50-50. We can dispute the exact vote count. But
it was 30-30-30, not 50-50.
Okay. The country seems very divided, and there's no clear political thrust going one way or the other. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that this division the country. The main problem now in Mexico, well, the main one of the main historical problem, is if oil, the national company of oil, should be privatized or open to private inversion capital or not. So some people say yes, and other people say no. The people who say no, I say no, thinks that the problem about Mexican oil is not only or just an economic problem. There is an economic problem. The national company is in bad shape. That shape can be changed. But what happened with Pemex, that is Petróleos Mexicanos, Pemex, the name of the national oil company, is that all of its gains are absorbed, how you say, sucked by the state. They paid more impuestos, more taxes than what they gain. They pay something as 55%.
It's a very important sort of source of revenue.
It's incredible because the rate of tax, the general tax rate in Mexico is 11%. It's ridiculous. That is covered by the gains of the oil. That cannot last. So, but that is not.
Well, that means that the company can't reinvest in facilities.
Cannot reinvest. That's the problem. From 30 years on, they have not invested. That's terrible. So we have to change the tax system in Mexico, but above all, rich people do not want to change, of course. But under that, I think that this is not the main problem. I think that the main problem is that this country, the United States, needs in the medium term, in the long and medium term, to control Mexican oil. It used to control it, America and Britain, up to 1938, when oil was nationalized. And since then, oil has sustained the development of Mexico, the industrial development, all that. Well, but oil is a strategic material for war and for everything. And these countries, that's the state of the facts, is not sure of what may happen with the oil at the east or at the west of the oceans. At the east, at the Pacific, or at the other side of the Atlantic, is very far. So it's normal that the United States wants to have a kind of control over the oil that is near Venezuela, Mexico, all that region. That's normal. But it's normal for Mexico to resist that kind of control. I am not condemning anybody. I'm saying what every country is doing and has to do. So that's the reason what I am against.
With oil prices now almost $110 a barrel, are Mexicans feeling any kind of general prosperity from that, or is that being all kept by people at the top of society?
Well, with the prices of oil now, we Mexicans could do a lot of things. But if all the gains of the national company goes to the government through taxes, and they cannot do any kind of investment, well, you won't have that oil, and the oil is there. The oil is there, but deeper and deeper and deeper. So you have to use new technology. They say we don't have new technology. We need foreign investment. Other people say foreign investment you can pay for it, but not give titles to the companies. With my English, perhaps I don't explain quite clear the problem because it is not so easy.
But they could bring in some foreign technology without turning the oil over to foreign owners.
Exactly. That's the question. You have said it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I know you have to move on and get up to NYU, so thank you for joining us.
I know that you have to finish too.
Okay.
I'm glad to have been here.
Okay, well, I've been speaking with Adolfo Gili, who is a distinguished Latin American historian and professor at the University, Autonomous University of Mexico. And let's take a break for station ID, and I'll be back a little more.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York?
New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 in your FM dial, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News. And let's take a musical break, and I'll be back to speak about celebrity.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star, and everybody's in movies, doesn't matter who you are. There are stars in every city, in every house and on every street, and if you walk down Hollywood Boulevard, their names are written in concrete. Don't step on Greta Garbo as you walk down the boulevard. She looks so weak and fragile, that's why she tried to beat so hard. But they turned her into a princess, and they sat her on a throne. But she turned her back on stardom, because she wanted to be alone. Can't see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood.
And that a bit of the Kinks' Celluloid Heroes from 1972 or 1973, an appropriate introduction to a segment on celebrity. And I'm joined in the studio by Elaine Tobin, who teaches at NYU and is a scholar of fame and celebrity, among many other things. I don't know if you got to hear that music, Elaine, but it was a memory of a different kind of celebrity. It was reverential and nostalgic, and we've gone a long way from that to today's kind of fame, where upskirt shots of Britney Spears are all over the web. What happened to celebrity over the decades?
There's a few things that I think that it's such an exciting week to be talking about celebrity. The easiest answer would be that with the dismantling of the studio system, stars' roles in their own careers really transformed. And instead of being owned by the studio, they started to function more like free agents do in sports. So stars became more responsible for their own image and hiring people to control or not control that image, whereas the studio had done all of that before. So you could have scandals in Hollywood, but they would be very orchestrated and very constrained, and there'd be all sorts of agreements with gossip columnists about what they would and wouldn't write about, et cetera, much like the White House in the Kennedy years.
Yeah, so the gossip columnists knew, but they just didn't report.
Yeah, they would make deals about what they would report and what they wouldn't. But as stars began to function through the 50s and 60s and 70s until today as free agents, the control of their image became both more crucial for their value as commodities and more difficult. So at the same time as that's happening, you have the unbelievable rise of the tabloid industry, both in print and now, of course, online and on television, which is a whole new revenue stream and very, very profitable. Tabloid magazines have had experienced in the last 2 years a 50% to 60% increase in newsstand sales, which hasn't happened for any other kind of publication. So if you go into the grocery store right now, it's almost impossible to find the New Yorker on the newsstand as you're standing in line. But it's very possible to see 7 or 8 very similarly covered tabloid magazines. And they're extremely important in shaping what gets reported in Hollywood. They're lascivious and scandal-driven, although some of them, such as People magazine, actually still think of themselves as doing real journalism, so they pull back a little. But then you have the web, which is uncharted territory, TMZ, YouTube, Gawker, And that's transformed celebrity in a variety of ways. Not only who can be a celebrity, but how celebrity is represented. And it's happening in real time. So we could watch, say, a Judy Garland of Days Gone By have a terribly tragic career arc, but we weren't watching it happen in real time, which is what's happening with Brittany and Lindsay in Paris, and to some extent Heath Ledger, which happened in real time. I mean, he was on the web within 4 minutes of the police being called to his apartment. So the speed and amount of celebrity culture that's around us is, it's almost difficult to analyze. It's like analyzing a tsunami, the results of which you haven't seen yet. It is ever-changing and very dynamic and quite difficult to get a grip on. The other thing that's really kind of fascinating to me and that's changing celebrity a lot is the question of celebrities and labor. If you watch shows, reality TV shows in particular, like Project Runway, you have people plucked out of obscurity, suddenly on TV once a week, very highly rated shows, performing free labor for our entertainment, one of whom will get, you know, $100,000 at the end of it.
No, but the reality, in Project Runway, those people have some talent. And
yeah.
A lot of people in reality TV don't have any particular talents at all.
Yeah, they're famously famous for being famous. But, you know, people eating bugs for my entertainment, I mean, I guess it's not traditional forms of labor, but it's a certain kind of work they're doing. And these shows, because they're so cheap to produce and so such a easy hit, are, you know, just kind of taking up all of the space where regular network programming used to be. So that's changing. You can work on Project Runway and be famous for a season. Most people who are on Project Runway, who are on Top Chef, you know, they don't end up opening their own restaurant. And they don't end up with their own clothing line. And they may get some ancillary spokesperson job or something like that. All of this means that fans and consumers of celebrity culture misleadingly sort of think that we actually can have the 15 minutes of fame that Andy Warhol promised us. And it's unclear to me whether they're wrong about that.
But some of them are limited to just those 15 minutes.
Yeah, just those 15 minutes. I mean, the Chris Cochran, the young guy who cried about Britney Spears on YouTube, you know, we haven't heard from him again. He may get a book contract, and, you know, Kristen may get a book contract, or Kristen Ashley Dupre may get a book contract, but it's not going to be a long-term kind of fame. And, you know, I think that one of the things we're going to start seeing is people who fail at American Idol auditions, or who are kicked off of American Idol, or who are kicked off of Project Runway. These are people who are going to suffer from sort of depression and alienation from having that promise soured.
But I'm quite a big Project Runway fan.
I am as well. I'm a huge fan of all of these shows.
but what struck me about it, watching it a few weeks ago, was that the real drama is about who's going to lose. I mean, this is American society used to be about the winner, it seemed, but now who is going to lose? So, the winner is almost an anticlimax. The big event is who gets kicked off the stage, and that's also, of course, a lot of other reality TV. Who gets kicked off the island and such. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that part of it that I feel ashamed about, I feel collective public shame when someone gets kicked off, which is what I'm supposed to feel, like both bad for them and that they have been shamed off the show. And they're often kicked off in really dramatic ways with really dramatic soundtracks and drum beats. I think that we...
Yeah, the soundtrack in Project Runway is like a firing squad.
Exactly. It's like a public execution. So I think that we are asked to pay a lot of attention as the season mounts to the way that the show's edited and the way that they're building narrative. You can tell in the first episode who's too boring to make good TV. Occasionally those boring people are extremely talented, so they'll make it further than they might have were it just a hatchet job of interesting versus boring. Project Runway, for example, Jillian, the designer who ended up with in Fashion Week, she's really not good television, but she was clearly such a talented designer, there was no real way the producers could figure out to get her kicked off.
Yeah, but she's kind of austere and dull.
Yes, she's very austere and very dull. In contrast, the other characters look so fantastically exciting, Christian and, you know, that they kind of helped balance each other out. I think that Top Chef is actually very instructive on this point. Because Top Chef, we can't taste the food. So we actually have no idea why they're getting kicked off, except to take Padma's word for it, or some of the other judges. And they are invited to describe things in the sort of the most insulting and horrifying ways of these poor young chefs. And we as an audience member are invited to think, oh my God, how could such a good chef make such a uninviting, unoriginal, drab dinner for Anthony Bourdain? They should be kicked off. That was irresponsible of them. You know, it's a very bizarre kind of theater.
But where are our identifications supposed to lie in this sort of thing?
I think our identifications are supposed to be split. This isn't a science, but I think we're supposed to identify with the winner. We really need to root for the winner. It's very difficult to want somebody to win who is really a tremendous jerk. And we are supposed to identify with one of the losers, which is why they've started now bringing losers back again that they know the audience liked, so that you can kind of be sad that they're gone, and then they return.
Chris on Project Runway.
Yes, in some prodigal son kind of way. So I think we're supposed to have split identifications. And then I think in a very complicated way, we're supposed to see the judges as kind of parental figures in whom we must trust, regardless of whether or not we feel they have earned that trust. I don't even know who half the judges are or where their expertise comes from, but they clearly are sitting in judgment in a way that I really can't. So I think the show's success is actually relatively sophisticated in the way that it asks a viewer to behave psychologically. And I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. The show that has failed for me is American Idol. I can't quite suffer through the humiliation that the candidates on American Idol are kind of asking me to suffer through. I get too anxious about watching it.
Now, the one thing I haven't watched, but I've read about, is the Fox show where they hook people up to lie detectors and ask them embarrassing questions.
Yes, I have seen one of those shows. I also watched the incredibly fascinating show Cheaters, where lay people who are not famous hire a detective company to find out if their partner's cheating, and then they mount a huge confrontation, sort of like Cops, but for infidelity. Sylvester Switzer might have wanted to call the producer for that show. It really is watching a train wreck. And on the one hand, I appreciate it as entertainment value, and there's a certain level of suspense and a certain level of schadenfreude and all sorts of things happening. On the other level, as someone interested in sort of the health of American culture, you can't really take this stuff seriously without realizing that it's having immediate and kind of frightening deleterious effects on the viewership.
I want to return to that question. I should say I'm speaking with Elaine Tobin, a professor at NYU, and a scholar of fame and celebrity. Actually, that leads me to my next question, which is, you're a highly educated person with a PhD. A lot of people have the attitude to, well, first of all, you know, this is stuff they're just shoving down our throats. The media industry is just shoving this down our throats. People don't really like it. You know, they're just not paying attention. They're just forced to. It's just trivial nonsense that's being shoved down our throats. And I'm sure a lot of people would wonder why a person like such as yourself actually derives a lot of pleasure from watching this stuff and following it. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, I think there's two things. The first about this being sort of ideologically shoved down our throat and shoved down our throat in the market as well is partly true. My mother knows that Angelina Jolie is pregnant. And my mother doesn't watch TMZ, and she doesn't really even watch the Oscars. So there's a way in which it's almost like oxygen. If you are living in a 21st century America, there's not a way to avoid a lot of this, either at the grocery store, online, the crawl on your CNN crawl when Britney gets arrested. So here you are watching something about the Middle East, and Britney with no underpants is on your CNN crawl. It becomes very hard to take yourself outside of that celebrity bubble. So on the one hand, it is shoved down our throats. On the other hand, it's a huge market, and there's no way to really pretend that that isn't a sign of our lust for celebrity gossip. In terms of somebody like me, I mean, I don't want to sound very high and mighty. I didn't come to studying celebrity culture from a more sophisticated perspective than my students or my friends or anything like that. I watch a lot of television, and I really believe that and no offense to your viewership, but if you don't own a TV, I don't really understand how you are in the world at this point, how you exist in the universe. And I think that I became obsessed with our obsession. So I took one step back from being obsessed myself, which I am, became obsessed with our obsession, became obsessed with the transformations I was seeing happen incredibly rapidly in the fame industry. And I'm obsessive compulsive. So for me, it's a perfect hobby because there's no end of it. I can look at a story that's large, like Britney Spears losing custody of her children, or a story that's really small, like whether or not Kate Hudson's bikini looks good on her. I can look at any of those kinds of levels of story and be really fascinated. And I have a really good track record of staying interested for a long time, so I can watch a career arc for a very long time without getting bored.
Well, you know, it's not unlike the financial markets, because, you know, which are supposedly very important things, but there's always this new piece of news that people will be obsessed about for an hour or a day, and then there's a new piece of news the next day that they're obsessed about for an hour or a day. So it's throughout the culture. Even,
it is, and if you treat humans like experimental mice and you put something new in front of us every day, we are going to pay attention to it. I mean, I'm not particularly interested in Patrick Swayze's career, but it's very sad that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer. I'm not sure I would normally have cared about that, but
it's pancreatic cancer, actually, isn't it?
Oh, it's pancreatic cancer. Yeah, I'm sorry. I hope his people don't email me. But it's very tragic and very sad, but, you know, I'm looking at it with a kind of interest that is sort of cultivated because I'm not particularly fascinated by him. He was in Dirty Dancing when I was young. That was interesting. He disappeared for a long time. And now he's on the front page of the Us Weekly that I have in front of me, Patrick Swayze's Brave Battle. And I think as a wordsmith, the second part of the answer is, as a wordsmith, I got interested in how tabloids in particular, but also television tabloid, speak about fame and the ways they manage crises in fame and the way they propel the market. So, you know, for example, exhaustion is my new favorite Hollywood word that's been around for a couple of years. Everybody's dying of exhaustion, and they're being hospitalized for exhaustion. And, you know, I'm...
Isn't that a euphemism for drug and
yes,
alcohol overdose?
Yes, of course it is. But most of us, you know, have never known anyone in our lives who was hospitalized for exhaustion.
I've got a two-year-old. I'm tired a lot of the time.
You are.
I'm not going to check into the hospital.
You might be next. Yeah. Just say you've checked in for drugs, because if you say exhaustion, Doug... And the way that romance works, I became fascinated with in Hollywood. I mean, I'm of the belief that almost no Hollywood marriage is an actual marriage. I mean, maybe 5% of them. So how those business arrangements are worked through, I became interested in. So I guess it appealed to every part of my psyche. The childish, give me more news now part of my psyche, the Freudian fascinations, and, you know, the Spitzer case, for example. I'm really sort of reading through the lens of Freud in a very powerful way. And visually, I find celebrity culture fascinating. So at every level, I find it fascinating. But I also think it's tremendously important to pay attention to it.
I think you said earlier it was deleterious to the culture. How is it deleterious?
I mean, I think, you know, well I'm going to just take one example to answer your question, which is this issue of how addiction is treated with celebrities. You know, if you watch E! True Hollywood Story, or even if you read slightly more sophisticated publications like the New York Times, you would think that drug addiction, alcohol addiction in some of these young stars and some not so young stars, Mel Gibson, for example, you would think addiction was a very short passing phase that was just sort of a poorly thought out set of choices and bad behavior. And 6 days in Promises Rehab or some beautiful cabin out in Utah will fix it. You had a glitch, you're back, you're fine, your life is moving forward, you're excited about your next project, etc. But anyone who's dealt with real addiction knows that is just not how the story goes. It is, of course, breaks up families, it is tragic, it's often the response to, or a self-medicating response to, serious mental illness, which I think we can pretty much agree Britney Spears seems to be a perfect example of. And it ruins lives, and it's often years of treatment and complications around that treatment. So I think young people today, for example, watching someone like Lindsay Lohan go into rehab for a little while, and they never worry about insurance, these stars, go into rehab, come out, look great, get a spray on tan, and go to a party and drink Red Bull and vodka the day after she gets out of rehab, and they think they can do that, right? I teach 18-year-old students, and I'm very fond of my students, but I have no doubt that a lot of them model their partying behavior, especially here in New York City, on what they think the stars do to party.
Yeah, I see people in this, women in the subway who look like they're trying to look like Paris Hilton, which amazes me.
I saw a woman dressed like Amy Winehouse the other day, which threw me for a loop. And this would be another deleterious, I guess, effect is, and I know I'm sounding like I'm hopping on a cliched bandwagon, but I really think the plastic surgery craze in the last 15 years has gotten to levels that are incredibly terrifying to me. I think that we don't even yet know what some of the side effects of some of these procedures are going to be. I think younger and younger girls are getting sets of breasts for their 16th birthday. Our bodies are being messed with. Huge amounts of money is being made doing it. Products that are very unrealistic are being marketed. And again, you know, I realize that I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna. I realize that there are probably some very smart people getting plastic surgery and injecting the Botox into their lips. But I also have this fear. I remember when mad cow disease came out, and I was completely convinced that because Botox is made from similar strains of, I'm not a scientist, but of bovine encephalitis, that the only people who would have immunity to mad cow disease would be women who had Botox injections, and that they would have to sort of run the government and everything like that. And I sort of was a joking fantasy, but so I think those are a few areas. I think the Spitzer case, because he is of course a political celebrity, is another case where we're gonna sort of see the level. And again, this isn't brand new. This has been happening ever since tabloids existed in the late part of the 19th century. But I think we're going to see the level of fascination with the news and where we instantly turn instead of where we might have turned 40 years ago, which was, wow, the governor has broken a whole bunch of laws that he himself has gone aggressively forward in trying to prosecute. And we're going to be going right to, let's look at Ashley Dupre's MySpace page.
Which she kept up. As no doubt as a career strategy.
And I'm positive she will have a book deal by the end of the month.
Or maybe a record deal. I couldn't listen to her song. It was kind of bad. But
she should go on American Idol.
She may well. But just parenthetically about Spitzer, it seems like almost a law now that anybody who's a high-profile public moralist has a secret life. It's almost as if they're using their public self to try to cope with their own unwanted private urges.
I think that's absolutely right. A lot of people have been saying Spitzer's such a hypocrite, this, that, and the other thing. I'm not denying that. But what really seems to be going on for me with someone like Spitzer or even, let's just say, Jim Baker or any of those guys, is that there's an internal demon that they're trying to externally manage and not the other way around. And that is, I guess that's the sort of the definition of how hubris functions. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. It'll be very interesting to see what happens to Ms. Dupre in terms of fame and stardom. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens to the Democratic presidential race as a result of this, because the charismatic Obama has to be worrying a bit. He's the same age as Elliot Spitzer. He's, you know, they haven't really raked him over the coals yet in terms of finding dirt about him. Hillary's got to be upset because she lost a superdelegate, and, you know,
she needed everyone she can get.
And she's, of course, part of her celebrity is awash in infidelity scandals. So there's contact anxiety going all around, I would imagine, on this.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to address this question. Who is making money off Britney and her train wreck?
Well, the tabloids are making a lot of money off Britney. Her lawyers and her parents are making a lot of money off Britney. Her handlers were making a lot of money off Britney. Her perfume lines and merchandising is making money off of Britney, although because Britney is not on tour right now and isn't insurable for films and can only do like one episode of TV, I think she's going to be on How I Met Your Mother in the next month.
And
or so.
Lindsay Lohan is uninsurable.
Lindsay
can't
Lohan,
make a movie
as
either.
Far as I can tell, is uninsurable, though but my lawyer friends tell me there are some ways around that. So they're really not generating income right now. So they're not making very much money at all, but the tabloids are. And Britney has started to sell fewer and fewer tabloids, so that's a problem. The people who are really making money as celebrities, and let's like take lawyers and all of those people who make a ton of money, are the celebrities who have branded themselves across a wide variety of areas, and P. Diddy comes to mind, and Sean Combs.
Whatever his name is this
yeah.
week.
Well, one of the reasons he renames himself is to rebrand himself. But his estimated net worth, and I could be even lowballing this, the last time I checked was $346 million. And that comes from endorsements, that comes from product lines, that comes from, you know, putting his name on a vodka endorsement, $10,000 just to show up at a Las Vegas lounge. And Lindsay Lohan is probably making her money that way right now as well, showing up at events, cutting ribbons, things like that. But it's a big industry, and there's a lot of money to be made, and it's not all but the stars themselves who are making it.
Yeah, I reached some point a couple of weeks ago, or a couple of months ago, it's the whole Britney story seems now heartbreaking. I mean, she's just being destroyed as a human being, and everybody's getting a big laugh at it.
They're the sacrificial lambs of the celebrity culture. I'm not saying they're not responsible, but if you had put me in that position at 20 years old, it would not have ended pretty. I'm not sure it would end pretty if you put me in that position now.
that's one thing we'd be grateful for. I've been speaking with Elaine Tobin, who is a professor at NYU and a scholar of fame and celebrity. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news on the evening, and let's go out with a bit more of this from the Kinks, Celluloid Heroes. Till next week. Bye.
You can see all the stars as you walk down Hollywood. Because her